I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The title of Chris Hayes' new book comes from a speech that Richard Nixon gave at the 1968 Republican Convention. He called for building bridges that separate black and white America, adding that black Americans, like white Americans, don't want government programs that create dependency. Quote, they don't want to be a colony in a nation. Hayes uses that quote in his new book called A Colony in a Nation to describe the two Americas that have been created by tougher crime laws over the last 50 years, resulting in two very different criminal justice systems. The one in the nation, he writes, is the kind of policing you'd find in any healthy democracy. The other, in the colony, is one you'd find in an occupied territory. He draws on lessons from the time we were a colony and chafed and finally rebelled against the British because of their arbitrary laws and mistreatment. Chris Hayes is host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He's also editor-at-large for The Nation, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to finally meet you and nice to have you with us on Radio
Time.
It's
nice to put a face to the voice that
Absolutely.
I've listened to for so long.
You quote Richard Nixon, this was a law and order speech that he gave at the Republican National Convention back in 1968. But what he said and what he did really contradict each other.
Yeah, I mean, that line, a colony in a nation, they don't want to be a colony in a nation, is almost not quite a throwaway, but it's not the point of the speech. And the point of the speech is we need to bring order to America. And in fact, the law and order framework that he launched with that speech, the kind of political argument he made to people, which was that there is a breakdown in order, and order has to be restored in order to have an ordered society, in order for the law to be restored. That was the kind of template for 40 years of criminal justice politics that produced policies that have made us the most incarcerated nation on earth.
The most incarcerated and also the most violent, which is an interesting thing to contemplate.
Well, I should say the most violent among developed countries, right? So there are places like Honduras and Guatemala and places that are far more violent. But among the kind of OECD cohort, America remains in some ways, astonishingly violent place.
But what's interesting, in the 60s and into the 70s and also into the 80s, and you lived in New York at the time, this was a country with a high crime rate. I mean, leaders were responding to the fact that it was violent, including the Congressional Black Caucus, saying there is a problem here. We have to address it.
Yeah, the crime wave that sort of happens in America starts in around 1966, which is also the year of the Watts riots. And one of the arguments that Nixon and others would make is this is what happens when you allow disorderliness, right? Rebellion, right? That the law falls apart and chaos ensues. The crime climbed across basically all categories in all geographic areas from 1966 to basically 1991.
Right.
And by 1988, 89, 90, 91, there was a real sense of crisis. I mean, the homicide rate in New York City was 30 per 100,000. There were 2,500 murders in New York City around in 1991. Last year, there were about 350, to give you a sense of that scale.
Which is a dramatic
unbelievably
change.
Dramatic. And in fact, the drop in crime is kind of one of the great social miracles of the last 34 years, and one that we actually don't have a great understanding of, which is I talk about in the book. So there is a real thing happening. People's lives really are becoming more violent. Crime really is going up. And it is particularly acute in poor black neighborhoods, in the sort of warrens of the colony, as I describe them. And what happens is you have political leadership in those areas, whether it's Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., whether it's black church leaders in Chicago and New York saying, this is a crisis, we need help. And the way that siren call is understood by white political leadership is more law and order and more cops.
And we're talking about three stripes and stop and frisk and zero tolerance and tougher sentencing and broken window theory. These were all the programs that got implemented to try to deal with this problem.
Yeah, and broken windows, I think, is particularly important in understanding this, because in 1982, James Wilson, George Kelling published an article in The Atlantic called Broken Windows. And they make an explicit argument that in some ways builds off of Nixon, and they even say reaches back to a kind of folk wisdom, which is basically this. Police should concentrate on what they call order maintenance, the vagrant with an open bottle, the surly teenager who's sitting on a stoop, public urination, right? Because in the title of the book, right, the title of the article, if someone sees a broken window on a street, it sends a signal, no one cares,
right.
Orders unraveling, so other people will do it. And so there's a real shift in the thinking of policing towards order maintenance. The problem, of course, is that order is a communally arrived at status, and it ends up being a sort of tool to enforce a certain kind of social hierarchy. You know, you have white cops who are not from the neighborhood enforcing what the order should be in places like East Harlem, and what you get is this massive escalation in the inputs into the criminal justice system, arrests, arraignments, prosecutions, pleas, et cetera.
As I said, you grew up in New York in the Bronx, I guess,
until
a certain age. So you lived in many ways in what was a violent city, and you described defending yourself. I mean, being on the alert that something could happen to you.
I think it's a little hard to describe the kind of psychological tax that people living in major cities at that time felt about the crime. And a psychological tax that is, at this very moment as we talk, still being paid in many neighborhoods and areas around this country in places where the homicide rate is astonishingly high. And in some sense, it's more than a psychological tax. I mean, widespread trauma if you go to the south and west side of Chicago, for instance. But for me, first person subjectively, there was just this constant awareness, this alertness, this kind of fight or flight module in my brain humming at all times, scanning the surroundings, preparing to pull the straps of my backpack up so that my backpack would be tight enough to my body that I could run in advance. And it sort of suffused everything I perceived about the city at the time. And that was something that was, I think, widespread throughout citizens across racial divide, actually.
Well, you talk about the trauma, the difficulty of living in high crime neighborhoods. We've done shows about something called toxic stress, which is children growing up in high crime neighborhoods are like in a war zone. I mean, they have the same kind of physical and emotional response
to
violence.
And this is part of the perversity of the way that this was dealt with, right? So you have entire populations that are living with incredibly elevated levels of stress and seeking refuge, safety, security. And what they are getting is a police force that so often treats them presumptively as enemies. There's this line in the DOJ Patterns and Practices report about Baltimore, in which a police officer instructs his subordinates, do not treat criminals like citizens.
Wow.
Well, wait a second. criminals are citizens, except for undocumented ones, but by and large. And in fact, citizenship is prior to criminality, right? Everyone is a citizen. Everyone gets treated like a citizen. That's actually a fundamental constitutional commitment we have as a people. But you also have this kind of occupying mindset. You see it in the Patterns and Practices report in Cleveland, in which an investigator walks into a vehicle bay in a poor, predominantly black neighborhood in Cleveland, and the vehicle bay is called – labels the place a forward operating base, which is a military term for remote outposts in a place like Afghanistan. So here you have a population that genuinely wants what everyone wants, safety and security and the integrity of their homes and kin and bodies. And what they are getting is a police force that does not treat them with the dignity and doesn't, in many cases, doesn't manage to provide that as well.
You include an interview that John Ehrlichman did, and I just want to quote a couple of lines here. And this is quoting Ehrlichman. He says, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know what we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did.
It's a shocking quote. And I should say that was not given to me. That was given, I believe it's Dan Baum who published that in Harper's.
But there it is.
There it is.
Quoting John Ehrlichman, who was obviously key in the Nixon administration.
And in some ways, right, the things that are always sort of twined here when we're talking about law and order and we're talking about crime is violations of the social order that are defined as crime and real violations of human relationship. Mm-hmm. Murder, robbery, assault, rape, right? So, and these two things run together in all kinds of ways. and you have a focus that shifts over time towards the order end of that spectrum under the theory that if you patrol that, then you'll stop the other stuff upstream. And I should say, just as an important point, because sure. I don't want to create a straw man here, around the time that this sort of proactive broken windows policing is adopted, afterwards there is a huge reduction in crime. It's not insane that many policy leaders think that the two are related, and to this day many make that argument. I think the literature shows that there's a pretty tenuous connection between those two, and that in many cases it's been perverted. But the social lesson that was learned was this is how you preserve order.
You also include a story about coming to Philadelphia for the Republican
yes.
National Convention. This was in 2000. You happened to have some marijuana in your backpack. What happened?
I was there with my then-girlfriend and my now wife and my future father-in-law, who's a political reporter in Chicago. And we got there, and I'd come down on the train. We're going to go sort of see it as a kind of sociological undertaking. I noticed that there's a checkpoint. I put my bag through the metal detector, and I think, okay, well, I'm fine. They're not going to, you know. And then eventually we get to a station where Philly cops are searching the bags, and a cop takes my eyeglass case out. It has a marijuana, shakes it, opens it up, turns around, and confers with two other cops, and I panic. I, you know, tell my father, future father-in-law, like, they just found weed in my bag. He's like, why would you do that?
Good question.
Why
right?
would you bring it? And after a minute or two, they put the bag back down. I take it. I go in. The weed's still there, and I'm not arrested.
Yeah. And is that because you're part of the nation?
Yes, I think so. I think there's a few things that happened in that moment. One is he didn't know whose son I was. I think about that a lot. Like, it was the Republican National Convention. You're dealing with a lot of important people. So are you going to create some huge firestorm over nailing some senator's son? Number two, in some ways, he was doing the right thing from a policing perspective. And it actually gets back to this really profound point. I think it's important, the difference between safety and order, right? His job there was a public safety job to protect the sanctity and safety of that space. It didn't matter relative to that mission whether I had a bag of weed or not. And he made the decision judiciously and I think properly, like, I'm not going to distract us from our core mission. But there's a broader lesson there for all of policing in certain ways, right? that the function is safety and security and not necessarily enforcing this kind of order. And the third thing I would say is it hits home the amount of latitude that every person operating in the criminal justice system has, from the beat cop mm-hmm. to the assistant district attorney all the way up to elected people like the district attorney.
We're up to break here, but also the assumptions that they make about someone that they are, if not arresting, at least talking to. The assumptions about who they think they are.
That's exactly right.
That is Chris Hayes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called A Colony in a Nation. He writes, in the nation, there is law. In the colony, there's order. In the nation, you have rights. In the colony, you have commands. To join our conversation, you can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more to talk about after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Chris Hayes. He's the host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He covered Ferguson. He covered Baltimore. Recently, he hosted a show with Bernie Sanders in West Virginia, a state that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And hopefully we can talk about that a bit later in the hour. His new book, A Colony in a Nation, is about the two Americas that have been created through our criminal justice system. Let me play a clip. This actually goes back to 1962, so it predates President Nixon. This is Malcolm X speaking on May 5th, 62, at the funeral service of Ronald Stokes after he was killed by the LAPD. The speech is called Who Taught You to Hate Yourself?
Once the police have convinced the white public that the so-called Negro community is a criminal element, they can go in and question, brutalize, murder unarmed, innocent Negroes, and the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals.
And again, Malcolm X speaking in 1962. I don't know if the cops were in cahoots with the criminals, but nonetheless, he really is describing the colony that you write about in your book.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Oh, gosh, that's an amazing clip. I think I'd read a transcript of that speech. But yeah, and I think one of the things – there's two things that makes me think of. One is that there's a long continuity here from before the kind of Law and Order era, right? I mean, this is 62. James Baldwin writes, I think in 1960 or around then, about cops moving through Harlem like soldiers in an occupied land or foreign land. You know, there are riots that happen in Harlem in the 19-teens because a white cop kills an unarmed black man. So there's a lot. And then, of course, back, you know, Jim Crow, slavery. But the other thing I think that's so key there is that use of the term police state.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's a really potent term, and it's potent for the following reason. We all understand the unique danger of the policing function as a state function, that it's both necessary but also dangerous, right? And the reason we use that term police state is to describe a government in which that function has been turned into something fundamentally toxic and oppressive. And there are huge parts of America in which the police are experienced exactly like that.
You actually did a little bit of police training. I mean, not enough right. to be a police officer, but enough training to understand what it's like to, I guess, have a gun in your hand and know that there is potential danger that you're going to have to deal with. What was that like? What did you learn?
It's a sort of virtual reality simulator that's actually used as a training device across the country. And you go through these scenarios. You have a gun that is an actual gun with real action that's been sort of retrofitted, so it fires infrared, and you can tell when you're hit from a thing that's strapped to your chest.
You can feel it.
Yeah, you can feel it. You get a shock actually. One of the things I learned is that policing a nation with 300 million guns is fundamentally different than policing in, say, the Netherlands or in Japan.
Because people are so well armed.
Because in every situation a police officer in the United States encounters, it is not implausible at all that someone will pull a weapon and fire. That potentiality just simply doesn't exist in many of the countries, for instance, that we're in the OECD cohort with, right? And that alters and colors the way that police are trained, the way they learn to think. The other thing that really struck me is how much of what policing is about at the street level is essentially conflict mitigation. You're called to a scene. I mean, we tend to think of it as we think of the standard of the homicide detective arriving where the yellow tape's already out and there's a body and they take out their notepad. Most of policing is domestic disturbances, you know, two people in the middle of a beef.
Very volatile situation.
Noise complaints, right? So you're showing up constantly, people with mental illness who are acting in ways that might be dangerous or threatening. You're constantly showing up in situations in which there's not necessarily a playbook for how to navigate them. What there is sort of your street sense, your experience, the authority that you could project to make people do what you say. And there are police officers who are incredibly adept at this. I mean, I talked to a cop who said, when you watch a cop use his words to bring the temperature down in a situation, it is a beautiful thing.
Wow.
And there are police officers who are incredible at it. There's a lot of police officers who aren't necessarily incredible at it, and it's not something they're really trained in any real way. I mean, even if just the number of hours of training they get, you know, the vast majority of it is on the kind of weapon survival side and way, way less on that kind of toolkit.
In fact, you say there needs to be more training on that side of the toolkit.
And that's something that police –
And you're probably not alone in that.
That's something that police officers say. I mean, I've had a cop say to me, you know, good policing is talking and listening. And I've also had cops say to me that the best weapon a cop has is his voice. And that's because of the percentage of incidents you have as a beat cop, particularly a beat cop. We're not talking about detectives, right? Particularly as a beat cop, the vast majority of interactions you have are the midst of conflict, disruption, chaos, disorder of some kind, right, that you are attempting to bring to some peaceful resolution.
You went to both Ferguson and Baltimore, covered what happened there after the shooting, first of Michael Brown and then of Freddie Gray. What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I mean, Ferguson was extremely eye-opening because it's it was like all of the problems with American race and policing in this distilled essence in this municipality of 20,000 people where majority black, 2 of 50 police officers are black, the city council majority white, white mayor, an insane practice of predatory ticket writing by the local police who essentially use the populace, the black populace, as a sort of revenue source via the court system. It was just it's an insane setup there.
Let me just interrupt you, and I'll actually quote you from that. So we're talking about Ferguson, a city of 22,000 residents. In 2014, 53,000 tickets given out for some kind of traffic violation.
And if you read the DOJ report, the emails that they acquired, in which city officials and law enforcement officials talk quite frankly about law enforcement as a means of producing revenue. Hmm. It's fundamentally extractive. And not just the ticket writing, but then the court system in which you have a summons. If you miss the summons, then you get a fine. If you don't pay the original fine, the fines go up. There are only a few hours during the week you can show up to make your summons. So sometimes you might show up and the line's too long, so you can't get into the court, so you get another fee. So you had an entire system built up in which law enforcement is used as to extract revenue.
I remember watching Ferguson, and it was one of the first times I saw military tanks where it really did look like not a police operation, but a military operation. And I think for a lot of people, that was shocking. I wonder for people living in Ferguson, was that so shocking?
I think the military equipment was pretty shocking. Everything about the policing was not shocking to anyone there. But that my sense was they were pretty surprised to see these units brought out as well. But it was a wake-up call to the country that police departments across the country have been profoundly militarized. There's an incredible book by Radley Balco called The Rise of the Warrior Cop, which describes this entire trajectory. And it harkens back to something that happened in our own founding in the revolution, which is that at a certain point, the British Crown began to militarize its police enforcement. It started to use naval vessels to enforce their customs laws. And there's an amazingly sarcastic broadside by Benjamin Franklin, I quote in the book, where he says, you know, oh, sure, here.
Here you go. I'm going to pass the book to you because I put a little green post-it there.
So now that the Brits have decided that they're going to use naval vessels, right, to enforce the laws, and this is what Benjamin Franklin says, convert the brave, honest officers of your navy into pimping tide waiters and colony officers of the customs. Let those who in the time of war fought gallantly in defense of their countrymen in peace be taught to prey upon them. Let them scour with armed boats every bay, harbor, river, creek, cove, or nook throughout your colonies. Stop and detain every coaster, every woodboat, every fisherman. Thus shall the trade of your colonists suffer more from their friends in time of peace than it did from their enemies in war. He concludes, oh, this will work admirably.
That's our own Benjamin Franklin talking
about the militarization of police.
Exactly.
Explicitly.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, there's a whole interesting section here about when we were a colony, we didn't like being a colony. We finally overthrew and the crown and had to deal with what sounds like civil forfeiture. I mean, all the kind of laws that we are hopefully beginning to question. We had to experience some version of that when we were colonists.
It really blew my mind to go back and reread the history of the revolution through the prism of policing, because I think we're taught that the revolution was about taxes and representation, which at some level it was. But the way that taxes are actually collected in the colonies is through customs enforcement, essentially police officers. And the way they figure out that you're smuggling, which was the huge lifeblood, the economic lifeblood of the colonies.
And I mean, thank you, John Hancock, for doing that.
Who is
right?
A huge smuggler. the lifeblood of the colonies is smuggling. And when the customs officers decide to crack down because like Ferguson, they need more revenue, you get essentially what I call the first era of stop and frisk. Right. You hear Benjamin Franklin talking about there. Every single boat can be pulled over and detained. And it is this indignity, this humiliation of this policing regime is the point of the spear. It's the spark of the revolution. John Adams would later recount a court case around searches and seizures and what were called general warrants as, you know, then and there, he says, was the spark of revolution. In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson has a line where he says, in the complaints about the crown, he says he has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. That harass our people and eat out their substance is literally what is happening, was happening, and I imagine is happening in Ferguson.
That is Chris Hayes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called A Colony in a Nation. He's the host of his very own TV show on MSNBC.
Is it that funny, Marty?
Maybe a little jealousy coming from.
Oh, no.
No. That's fine. That's fine. It's all good. But we are talking about his book, which both looks at our own history when we were a colony and talks about a dual justice system, as Chris Hayes sees it, that has led to a kind of two Americas. And again, to join our conversation, you can call us, you can text us at 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to play a clip from President Obama, but let me just, picking up on what you just said, former President Obama, are you saying if, as a colony, we rebelled against the British because of all these onerous laws, that we are experiencing that in the colonies that live within this country?
Right. So, obviously, the structures are quite different from a sort of democratic perspective, political economy, but the experience of humiliation is similar. And I think the experience of humiliation is vastly underappreciated as an engine of human affairs, and particularly as an engine of social change, as an engine of revolution. The angry person can shout, the grieving person can cry. It is the particular nature of humiliation to have nothing to do with the humiliation to express it, because it is the very moment that you're being humiliated by a police officer who has total control over you in that moment that you cannot do anything to let it out. And so the nature of humiliation, particularly systemic humiliation of this kind, is that it builds and it builds and it builds and it has to find some outlet. And I think that is what we have seen over the past several years, particularly as this sort of new civil rights movement has grown up.
I often think that shame is one of the most, not pernicious, but just one of the most difficult emotions to try to deal with, understand, figure out how to express.
Yep.
Well, let me play a clip, and this goes back to July 2016. This is President Obama speaking following the deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile.
When incidents like this occur, there's a big chunk of our fellow citizenry that feels as if, because of the color of their skin, they are not being treated the same. And that hurts. And that should trouble all of us. This is not just a black issue. It's not just a Hispanic issue. This is an American issue that we should all care about. All fair-minded people should be concerned.
Interesting listening to President Obama speaking. I mean, he was speaking about the things that you are writing about here.
Yeah, and I could not agree more with the point he makes there that this is not just a black issue. And I think at the beginning of the book project, as I was conceiving of it, I had some reticence about writing it because obviously I'm not the best person to write about the experience of being on the wrong side of this sort of law and order equation. But at the same time, it also strikes me as important to recognize that this – what is happening around criminal justice and race particularly and policing does a kind of fundamental violence to our shared democratic commitments as a people in terms of what our ideals are civically, and that we all have a stake in that. And that also it's a system that was brought about through democratic means. There wasn't some like backroom special interest lobby that made this thing. I mean, there are pieces of policy like banking regulations where that really does happen. There's no actual democratic momentum for it, right? For, you know, the bankruptcy bill. This was the product of democratic action. It was majorities of people voting to have things like mandatory minimums and lock them up and three strikes and you're out and electing district attorneys who promise to get tough and electing mayors who ran on platforms of rolling up the thugs. And so we all as a democratic people have created this and we all have to be held to account for it. And I think one of the things that ends up happening, and this is a conversation I've had with police officers a lot in the course of this, is we think of it, it's very easy to think of it as a policing problem because then it's like the police, those people, they're bad, they're racist. And there's a lot of problems in American policing too, not get me wrong. But the police are an institution that is also fundamentally should be democratically accountable and that are the creation of our democratic politics. And so we have to take ownership of it and not just put it on the individual police officers or police departments.
We're almost having a break here. You mentioned humiliation. I also think fear. I mean, fear is a powerful emotion and drives a lot of policies.
There's a particular legacy in this country of a certain kind of fear. From the moment that the first ship landed at Jamestown and the captain writes in the first entry of his diary, we were set upon by the savages. That the foundational experience of the sort of settler colonial project is one of both fear, violence, and conquest in this kind of never-ending loop. And that is our deep sort of socio-emotional inheritance as Americans. And it plays in all kinds of registers throughout our politics to this day.
That is Chris Hayes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We will take that very short break, get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Again, you can call or text our comment line to join that conversation. And that phone number is 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, covering a lot of territory in this hour of the show. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Chris Hayes is our guest, host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His new book is A Colony and a Nation. He's also editor-at-large for The Nation. Well, we heard President Obama speaking last July. This was candidate Donald Trump answering a question about racial bias in policing at the first general election debate. This was September 2016.
We have to bring back law and order. Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well, Mayor Giuliani is here, it worked very well in New York, it brought the crime rate way down. But you take the gun away from criminals that shouldn't be having it. We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases, they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns, and they shoot people. And we have to be very strong, and we have to be very vigilant. We have to know what we're doing. Right now, our police, in many cases, are afraid to do anything. We have to protect our inner cities because African-American communities are being decimated by crime.
That's interesting on several different levels to play that. And one of the reasons I wanted to play it is that it feels as if there has, Trump aside, a shift in thinking about the level of mass incarceration. I see the ACLU and the Koch brothers, I believe, and libertarian groups kind of on the same side saying this is expensive. It's creating economic, social, political problems within communities that are hard hit by crime. And we have to rethink some of our approach to law enforcement. This is a real law and order president that we have today.
Yeah, I think there's more of a think tank consensus than there is a political one. The think tank consensus is a real thing. I think you've seen policy wonks and elites on the left and right increasingly do converge on this about what a disaster mass incarceration has been. But the politics that drove those policies is still there, as evidenced by the man who is the currently president of the United States, who won quite explicitly on those politics. In fact, on an even less restrained version of it than Richard Nixon. I mean, Richard Nixon sounds like Barack Obama compared to Donald Trump talking about law and order. I mean, Richard Nixon has way more veiled equanimity than that, or just I will be the law and order. I mean, I'm struck in that quote, too, just in terms of how the politics of this work and the appeal. gangs roaming the streets, right. roaming. Right. Well, what kind of creatures roam? Humans don't roam. Animals roam. And there's a sense in that a lot of the way we talk about crime, the object of our concern is the criminal as opposed to crime. And that's a really key paradigm that we have to undo. If the problem are criminals, we are talking about essences, kinds of people. If the problem is crime, those are acts that individuals can commit discreetly and then not commit again, be rehabilitated from, ask forgiveness from, be held to account for. But when you talk about gangs of criminals roaming the streets, what you're talking about are essences. You're talking about criminals. You're talking about packs. You're talking about animals that are out there, not fellow human beings who do things. And a huge part of the kind of Copernican revolution that has to happen in the way we think about crime is to move away from essences to acts.
I've interviewed police commissioners here in Philly, the head of the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania. But again, they sound more like you than they do Donald Trump. So while, yes, elites might be talking about this, I also think people that are immersed in the system, they see the effects.
I think almost anyone who is in the system views it as slightly bonkers or totally bonkers. I mean, it is just impossible to square the Bill of Rights, the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, the commitment to kind of liberal democracy and procedure with the reality of what the criminal justice system is day after day, which is essentially a conveyor belt, a factory like Lucy in the chocolate factory attempting to get the chocolates in the box. Like that is what it is, a factory to move people through a process of arrest, arraignment, to plea, to jail or parole or another summons. It's a conveyor belt. We get this sense, and I think pop culture doesn't help here, where pop culture representations of the criminal justice system focus on things like jury trials. We don't have jury trials in America.
Tiny percentage.
It's a vanishingly small percentage of what the criminal justice system does. The jury trial is, we think of, oh, this is we're doing our thing as a democratic people where we have this, you know, adversarial process and our fellow citizens are going to judge us and 12 angry men. No, that is not what the system does. 98, I don't know the exact, it's around, right around 98% of things are pled. Plea bargains, by the way, didn't even exist at the time of the founding. So if you want to talk about originalism,
right.
But it's just impossible to square what these sort of abstract commitments we have are with what is actually functioning on the ground every day.
We began with you talking about not being arrested in Philadelphia in 2000 when they found marijuana in your backpack. Let me read a comment from Susan. She says, I think my white friends who protested the 2000 GOP convention in Philadelphia, and there were many of them, would have been arrested if cops had found weed in their backpacks because they would have been profiled as protester types based on their hairstyles and clothing.
I think that's a great point. And I think it speaks to the fact that the borders I'm talking about and the ways that policing work, it's not solely functioning along race lines. And in fact, protesters in protest situations, and right now with the sort of socioeconomic decline that large swaths of white working class America are facing, there's sort of remarkable new data out about this today.
I have it in my hands.
There's ways in which the kind of colony is breaching the borders, overflowing the banks, and it is an open question as to whether the tools of enforcement that have been used in the colony for so long will now be starting to be applied to these parts of formerly the nation that are starting to look a lot more like the colony.
Well, and the information that people are responding to comes from Princeton University. These two researchers, Ann Case and Angus Deaton. Deaton actually won the Nobel Prize for economics a couple of years ago. They talk about the sea of despair among white working class Americans, which got me thinking about the opioid crisis, which, of course, is not just in poor working class parts of the country, but it is a serious problem in those parts of the country. And what I hear is we need more mental health services. We need more ways of intervention. We need Narcan. Very different from how we dealt with the heroin crisis.
And the crack epidemic,
and the
particularly.
Crack epidemic.
I mean, the crack epidemic was so racialized, and the language was so dehumanizing and brutal, and it was so much about the thugs and cracking down and the dealers. And this is a very different rhetoric. Okay. And the New York Times wrote up about a great piece about this, sort of when addiction has a white face and how different the rhetoric is. The one thing I would say to complicate that a little bit, though, is we have a real long heritage and shared desire to punish. And I was just down in McDowell County. And McDowell County has the highest rate
in West Virginia.
In West Virginia, highest rate of drug-induced deaths in the country. Its rate is 141 per 100,000. To give some context, the highest the homicide rate in New York City ever got was 30 per 100,000. Okay, this is absolute crisis level that is happening there. I asked people in the room to raise their hand if a loved one they know has been an addict, if they've lost someone to addiction, and almost every hand in the room went
lost
up.
Their
lost
someone died.
Almost every hand went up.
Wow.
At the same time you're hearing treatment, jobs, et cetera, you're also hearing a lot of crack down. We need to get tough. You gotta be tough with these people. So that impulse is still there. And I'm still a little skeptical about which policy manifestations we're going to see. People should not underestimate the power of punishment and toughness as an almost kind of like vestigial and reactive knee-jerk reaction to any problem that we're faced with.
It will be an interesting test. I mean, part of the argument could be, well, we saw what happened when we dealt with crack cocaine. That was actually harmful to so many communities and to so many families. Maybe we have learned something, or maybe, as you say, we're still back to fear and punishment.
Well, what I think there also is, though, is what happens is there's a tendency to focus on the drug as opposed to the conditions that produce the addiction. I mean, they're both problems. But, you know, crack came into urban communities and the drug itself did a lot of damage, and particularly the structure of drug markets, which balkanized in ways that created a lot of violence, did a lot of damage. But those communities have been in tremendous crisis before the drugs, and that's what's happening now. I mean, the opioid crisis is a symptom as much as it's a cause of anything.
Let me a message from Oyello from South Philadelphia. What can the common person do as far as voting, policy making? How can we get our politicians more involved?
So you guys, that's a great question here in Philadelphia, where you guys have a really fascinating and contested district attorney's race. And one of the things that happened recently is people have started to realize just how key a role prosecutors play in the system. Prosecutors have tremendous latitude. There's some great empirical work by a man named John Pfaff, who's got a great book out right now called Locked In, about mass incarceration, in which he really identifies prosecutorial discretion and the desire to punish more, have longer terms, as a key driver of mass incarceration. And those offices are set at the top through Democratic means. You guys have an election right now. You got a current DA who's facing his own issues. And getting involved in those local races is a great point of entry for citizens concerned about this.
A tweet from Christopher. It seems to me neither side will take their own actions and choices into account. Everyone just blames. Do you share that pessimism?
No. I mean, I do think that communities, particularly communities of color, sort of denizens of what I call the colony, feel correctly and rightly persecuted, oppressed, harassed. I also think that, you know, policing is a tremendously difficult job. And I think police often feel that they are not given enough credit when they do right. There's a little bit of the and this is true of sort of all of all professions, right? Like, we didn't cover the priests who didn't molest children, right? And I talked to priests. I remember reporting on that scandal and priests feeling like they had been, you know, every priest had suddenly been tainted by the actions of these few. Like, and I feel cops do feel that way. Now, part of that's just a product of the way the media works. We have a slogan that, you know, we don't cover the plains of land. And so there's part of that. But there's part of that also where it's like, we do have higher standards for people that wield force on behalf of the state. And, you know, there's a reason that police are held to this standard, as hard as that job is. And it really is brutally hard in many, many ways. It is held to a high standard because to get back to that original idea of a police state, it's such a kind of powerful and potentially dangerous function of the state.
You were in West Virginia with Senator Bernie Sanders. Again, this was a state that won overwhelmingly by Donald Trump. I watched a bit of it. It was interesting to, as you mentioned, the fact that the opioid epidemic has hit everybody there. But it was interesting to see Bernie Sanders with those people, and it seems that his message had great appeal to them.
Yeah, there is a certain – I mean, I think the thing – one way to understand Bernie Sanders that I think in some senses actually hurt him a bit in the primary is that he represents a white – rural and largely a huge working class state outside of the sort of Burlington areas right. like that. And he's represented it for 30 years. He's very good because he's a gifted politician in that sense of talking to folks about those issues and where they live. And so that's not foreign terrain in some ways for him. And particularly because so many of the issues that are faced by rural white working class communities across huge swaths of the country are quite similar.
Right.
I think that's in some ways a natural environment for him.
I mean, it was the same message that he had on the campaign trail about equality and access to care and, you know, some kind of Medicare for all
yep.
or his version of that. I mean, it's interesting to run the impossible experiment, which is if he had beat Hillary Clinton, would he be president of the United States? Have you thought about that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think everyone runs that counterfactual.
Sure.
People run a million different counterfactuals about the election. I don't know. I think it's fundamentally unknowable. I do think that he has a particular set of rhetorical gifts around communicating with a particular constituency, again, because of right. a lot of the ways of who he represents and of communicating basically social democratic ideas without let's say a lot of cultural baggage that I think those voters mm-hmm. tend to associate it with.
We're almost out of time here, but I mean, in many ways you are describing two Americas. Martin Luther King talked about two Americas. Michael Harrington wrote The Other America,
right, yeah.
which I remember reading as I was in high school and in college growing up. Maybe we just really are two Americas. Maybe that's who we are.
I think we are. Here's what I think. I think stable, flourishing, just, humane, pluralistic, multi-ethnic, multiracial democracies are tremendously difficult things to build. They are the product of ceaseless struggle. They're the product of vibrant civil society. And there is no stasis endpoint at which they have been built and then can be just sort of admired the way you would a sandcastle. They are a constant process. There's no end state for them, partly because it is so difficult. And that's, to me, the point here, right? That we have built something in the form of the criminal justice system that is fundamentally unjust and also fundamentally a kind of insult to what our shared democratic commitments are. And the project of democracy is constantly calling ourselves back to account to what those commitments are.
Well, the perfect place to end our conversation. Chris Hayes, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was my great pleasure.
And the book is called A Colony in a Nation, and he is the host of All In with Chris Hayes at MSNBC, and he's also editor-at-large for The Nation. That's it for Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. We also took some pictures, which you can check out on our Facebook page. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.